Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. A couple things to tell you about before I jump into this interview. The second book, if you've noticed, will be out the 31st of January. That's the last day that I have to get it out in January for you to still match the January date. Like I said, the audio book will also be with it, which I do read. The second edition definitely has some changes. A lot of changes at the end. I actually removed chapter 15, the healthy core routine, changed a couple other things up. But if you have purchased the first edition book, I know I got a lot of emails already, but I know there's a lot more. So I just want to make sure that if you bought the first book, if you would please email like a picture proof you with the book or something like that, do a big Cognitive Rampage or something, and I'll send you a free electronic copy of the second edition. So if you bought the first one, you get a free electronic copy. It's the least I could do is send that book to you. But Dollar Mental Health Club, we have pushed back till March. We've been saying February, but there is legal things to take care of. We are also doing some hiring, and there's a lot of people to interview and go through. And I want to make sure we have the right people ready to go for Dollar Mental Health Club. So 30 more days, won't kill you, won't kill us, but we're dying to get it out. But we want to make sure we're releasing it to you and it's working properly. We got the right people there for you. But Dollar Mental Health Club is essentially a paradigm shift in mental health. We're trying to change that paradigm, basically bring affordable mental training, not necessarily diagnosis management. This is not counseling or therapy, but quicker tools and strategies you apply in the present for a dollar a minute. You call anywhere, you pick your time 24/7. Now to the exciting stuff that I've been looking for. My guest on the podcast today, Dan Cleland, is deep, deep, deep in the ayahuasca world, in the spiritual world, in the transformation world. If you have not heard of ayahuasca before, welcome. You're going to get an education in it today. If you have, and if you're a listener of Cognitive Rampage, I'm sure you have heard of ayahuasca at least, if not even tried it yourself. So I am a proponent. I'm an advocate of it. I've seen it do amazing things. I love hearing the stories. If you actually go back, way back in the beginning of the Cognitive Rampage, it's on like episode 20 or something, Damiano came on, who's a friend of mine up in Canada, who changed his life. And went to Peru on an ayahuasca, I don't even like retreat. It was more like a rebirth and changed his whole life. His story was interesting. He did a wonderful, beautiful trip report for us on the Cognitive Rampage. Now, here we are fast forwarding way over to the guys like Dan Cleland that make this happen, that make it easy, make it scary, right? There's a lot of difficulty and anxiety in doing something like this, especially overseas, where Dan does his Pulse tours. But Dan, thanks for coming on the show, man. I've already started with the questions kind of already, man, but thanks for coming on.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Adam. I appreciate the invitation and really look forward to digging deep here with you and sharing some value with your audience.
Well, that's kind of what your story brings, the way I read it, you know? You know what I liked about your story, too, which, you know, you hear over and over again the stories about, you know, I had this so terrible, life was awful. I mean, there's some bad, bad stories. And you hear that a lot, and I'm not downplaying that. But, you know, the average person, the average Joe that may not have this serious childhood trauma or something, but that does what they're supposed to do, gets their job, goes, you know, does it, but still goes through that same similar idea of not feeling fulfilled or something like that. You don't embellish on the darkness of what you came from, more kind of like the rebirth, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, I withheld a few things in my story for, you know, for personal reasons, but, okay. You know, I ultimately had a fairly normal upbringing. You know, I had a loving family and all that kind of stuff. But for me, you know, really my personal difficulties were maybe some innate kind of psychological tendencies toward depression and kind of self-judgment and self-contempt that, and then also some type of strange need to carry the burden of the world on my shoulders, especially in terms of like in environmental issues and stuff like that. So, I mean, when I had kind of entered the life of an adult, so to speak, with jobs and the typical humdrum of bill payments and all the stuff that you just kind of naturally progress into as an adult, I just, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a deep, dark necessarily period for me, but it was, there was just some lack. There was just like some type of lack of depth or fulfillment or satisfaction. And I didn't take the normal route and just, you know, try to fill that by getting married and having kids in my 20s. You know, I kind of avoided that. I've got a few friends who have gone that route, you know, kind of gone even further down the prescribed program and got married when they were in their early 20s or whatever, and have kids, and you know, maybe they're divorced now, or maybe they're, you know, in their mid 30s, like just grinding it out, trying to take care of a family or working the same job they've had for ages, and still feeling that kind of disconnect, or like, what have I done with my life kind of thing, you know? So.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Anybody, I think, can relate to that, you know, because you strive forward, time goes by, you perform well, right? We do what we're supposed to do, and you find yourself going, is this it? Is it Tuesday nights we watch this series? And then we, you know, you, I think anyone listening can relate to that feeling more so what I mean than, you know, those traumatic feelings. When I opened, I didn't mean to say that you hadn't had them. It was more or less that it wasn't so much that was pushing you to, it became this normalcy life, really, this doing what I was supposed to. That was finally the push, you know, that said something's got to change. And that's what I loved, is that's something I think in your story, millions of people can relate to where they go, all right, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And there's more, there's gotta be, right? You know, that question I think we all ask.
Yeah, for sure. Just that brightness, that compelling future. Tony Robbins talks about the compelling future, you know, this something that, you know, something beyond just accepting the fact that you kind of wake up and go to work and pay bills for the rest of your life. You know, that's not exciting for a lot of people yet. It's necessary for most people. It's you as an entrepreneur know that it takes a certain mental shift, mental growth to move into that, you know, kind of taking on all the risk of entrepreneurship and managing your lifestyle on your own terms, and you know, not necessarily knowing when the next paycheck's going to come in, but trading that, you know, you trade up
facing that fear, you know, yeah. Facing that fear. I think we're talking about fear here, right? Is that we, so a lot of people, I think, do build that life because they see the stability. They want to eliminate the fear. So the more steady I can be, I've done what I'm supposed to. I think they find a comfortability, right? And that fear is kind of what I see, right? And that entrepreneur is kind of that step to going, oh, fuck. You know what I mean? And you just jump and face that.
Yeah, man, for sure. Like, I've had plenty of ups and downs since fully going into just fully accepting the lifestyle of an entrepreneur. You know, you've got, man, I've gone through everything from like email anxiety to like just days of like, you know, you feel like you're in the perfect spot and everything's great and you're just loving your life and you get a big smile across your face. And then other days where it's like, fuck, I'm in way over my head. Like I can't handle this anxiety or whatever. and recurring issues that come up in business, you know, over and over and over again. Yeah, I mean, it's ups and downs for sure, but ultimately you look at what you're trading off. You trade off that gritty kind of reality of uncertainty. You trade off that uncertainty to have stability when you go for like traditional employment. It's like you were saying, you get that stability, you get, you know, at least some semblance of a fairly stable future. You've got a profession, you've got a trade. You've got a job with a company that's been in existence and has a fairly bright future. So you can count on your $5,000 a month or whatever going forward. But you know, like, again, there's, I think quite a few people out there that, I mean, genetically, we, our biology kind of in a way craves that sense of adventure and that sense of challenge and the unknown, I think. And so while some people are genetically predispositioned to be comfortable in a stable, kind of environment, there are others that maybe don't feel so comfortable in that stable environment and who crave that sense of adventure. And I mean, business can be an adventure. Travel can be an adventure. Business can be an adventure, you know, because ultimately the adventure is the difference between your competencies and the risk you're taking. And yeah, if that difference is big, then, you know, you can be taking risks in business or in life or in sports, you know, or whatever.
Marriage, relationships,
for sure.
Yeah.
I guess it's all how you look at it.
So for you, when did Mother Ayahuasca show up? When did you face the fear? Walk me to when she first, and I'm referencing her as that. I was a little researched and learned it myself, but when did it first impact you? When was it? Did it call to you essentially?
Well, I mean, that actually was a bit of a dark point in my life. I was actually struggling quite a bit. I was in pretty bad physical shape. I was recovering from a physical accident that left me bedridden for about a month and a pretty long recovery.
What happened, man? If you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure. So I had a rock climbing accident, but it wasn't so much rock climbing as it was Friday night's drunken mistake that I made trying to scale a cliff without any safety equipment or spotters or anything.
Shit.
So that was kind of like the culmination of about 8 months of challenging situations. I moved to Australia hoping to accomplish a few things, and I encountered some significant challenges. Didn't really work out, and I was struggling to make some cash. I was struggling to kind of get it and continue my studies and find decent work. Just was out one night, sculling back Jim Beam and
asking for it. You were fucking asking for it, man. Yeah, I got you.
So, man, I don't know if you've ever been in the situation where you can drink to celebrate, you can drink to chill out, or you can drink because you're fucking angry, you know? When you're drinking because you're angry, usually that's when the bad things happen. So whiskey is probably the worst thing you can drink when you're angry, right?
Yeah, that's not good, man.
Mm. So I ended up having this accident, put me in the hospital in Australia for a month.
Fuck.
And I busted open my femur and my pelvis. So like compound fractures, it's really, really messed up.
Shit.
So, I mean, I'm full of titanium now. I got titanium from knee to hip and across my pelvis.
Fucking part Iron Man and shit.
Bionic man. Yeah.
All right.
Cyborg.
Silver lining, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of disaster prompted me to research ayahuasca. Now that was back in 2009. And I was already aware of it. I was already aware of ayahuasca. I'd read about it. I was kind of following like the spiritual community and the alternative thinking kind of community. So, you know, I'd heard about it in the past. And then when I was actually in a bit of a bind there, I figured, what the hell? It's time for me to try this. So I rigged it up and about a few months later, 6 months later, I ended up actually having my first ceremony down in New Mexico in the United States. And yeah, that was exactly what I needed. It was, I mean, before I went into that ceremony, I'd probably taken like mushrooms and acid like a couple hundred times. Like I started, I mean, I was, I started taking LSD in like when I was 16 years old or something.
Pushing the subconscious, trying to wake it up. I see where you're at, man. It's like, yeah, I've been there, man. And yeah. So you go to New Mexico. Was this, who were you with? Was it a charted thing? Was it something you discovered, a friend of a friend?
Man, it was really actually crazy how I found myself there. So on my way back, once I was healthy enough to like walk after my accident in Australia, I decided to quit in Australia, go back to Canada and try to, you know, patch my life back together. On my way there is when I intended to go down to Peru and do ayahuasca. So I flew into LA from Brisbane, you know, direct flight. Then before flying from LA to Toronto, I decided I'm going to run a little detour down to Peru. And so I did. I flew down to Lima, took a bus up to Cusco, and my plan was to go down into the jungle of Puerto Maldonado to go to this retreat center that I was looking at. I didn't have anything booked. I was hoping, you know, that I could just kind of like show up and knock on the door and they'd let me join this retreat that I knew was happening. but yeah, some crazy shit happened in Cusco. I was just, I was still kind of in bad shape, got altitude sickness, was kind of, hold up for a couple days. Then I went out looking for some fun, found some people, part some Australians and New Zealand's partying for Anzac Day. It's like a national holiday. So that, you know, they start drinking at 11 o'clock in the morning, and hooked up with a few guys there, spent the whole day partying at about like 3 a.m, walking home from the discotheque. Got robbed at Machete Point. So I was just standing in front of my hotel, and this car pulls up and some guy jumps out, puts a machete in my face, and a couple other guys like jump out and take everything out of my pocket. So I had like no cash. I had like the equivalent of about $3 in my pocket. The next morning when I woke up, like with a super crazy hangover, so I go down to the local market to get some breakfast, and I get the local fish soup, like the cheapest thing in the menu. And a couple hours later, violent vomiting, diarrhea, like, so I'm in my room for another couple days, no money, just like, wow, just get my ass handed to me. And so I had to make that phone call home, like, yo, dad, need some cash, got to get home, I'm kind of in some rough shape here.
Yeah, I just almost died from soup and machetes.
Yeah, but the silver lining in that was on my bus ride up from Lima to Cusco, I met this dude. He was like, there's a whole bunch of people standing out waiting for the bus, like just having a smoke or whatever. And I just, this one dude just like stood out to me. I just like, he's like this kind of scruffy looking like blonde guy. He had like Native American tattoos on his forearms. And I was just like, this guy looks like he's from BC, like British Columbia, Canada. So, and I don't know, something just like drew me to him. So I just went up and chatted with him for a bit, he had some cool tattoos, asked him where he's from. Sure enough, he's from British Columbia. I told him he looks like he's from BC. That's where he's from. So
you stereotype him for.
But then, yeah, So he had an interesting story. He was actually down in Peru doing he had just finished an ayahuasca retreat, and he explained to me that he was involved with the Native American church back in New Mexico. So he's from BC, but living in New Mexico, and he kind of like given up on all of the Western ideals and everything. And, you know, he was pissed off about the genocide, you know, when the Europeans came over and kind of slaughtered the natives of the area and stuff. So now he was like kind of, I guess, half native. He kind of taken on the native life philosophy.
Like me, man. I dig it. Yeah, shit. It's all tatted up here, man.
Oh shit.
Red cloud's sitting right over there. I turned
Nice.
the camera over there, man. Yeah, my Croatan, but proceed, man. I'm into this story, man. I'm deep, man.
All right. So I meet this guy in the bus ride. Going up to Cusco. We chatted it up. He had actually brought some peyote down from the States. So he invited me to come join him for a peyote ceremony. Then we got to when we got to Cusco, we parted ways. He was staying in one place, I was staying in the other. And then all that shit happened with me, and I didn't talk to him for like 5 days. I didn't hear from him. And then after I had made that phone call to my dad, like, and I had organized a new flight for like a day later or something, he calls me up at the hotel. And so on his first day in Cusco, he was up like meditating on one of the mountains overlooking the city. And he fell into a trance, and he fucking fell off the mountain. And so he like rolled down this hill, and he busted up his face and his shoulder and all this shit. So he was in the hospital and like busted up and healing for a few days while I was getting my ass kicked in Cusco. But then on the last day, we ended up linking up and going up in the mountains, renting some horses and going out, taking some peyote, checking out some Inca ruins and shit. And then a couple months later, you know, I went back home. He went back to New Mexico. A couple months later, he invited me to come down for a ceremony in New Mexico. So
fuck, man, it's like you had to get tested. Like ayahuasca tests you. We'll get to how that goes, but like the purging, the intense go throughs. It's like she had to like go first. I'm gonna see how serious you fucking are. Are you willing to get robbed at machete point and stay? Are you willing to you know, ask a guy that you think is something? Now, like you got pushed and pushed and pushed to this brink to where no one wants to make the phone call. You know, hey parent.
Oh God.
Yeah, no one wants to make that. And that's like the last test of pride there that you had to make. You know, I'll fall down a mountain 5 times before I'm fucking making that phone call. You know what I mean? So it's like the last test of pride. You got pushed and then like you passed. And then they like, and as much as you needed to meet this dude needed to meet you. And wow, man, that's fucking awesome. That is beautiful. I mean, shit.
Yeah, it was one of those meetings, you know, one of those connections that is like life changing. And you know, I've never seen the guy since that ayahuasca ceremony. Barely talked. Like, I mean, I talked to him for a little bit after, but he's kind of off the map and
fucking ghost, man. He's a ghost, bro.
Yeah. But yeah, I'll never forget that. I should look him up, man. I really should. I should get a hold of him because
I don't know if I should okay. Yeah. Yeah. He may be off the grid kind of person. Yeah. That's not.
Yeah. And then like you've got also people in the U.S. that like hunt down illegal ceremonies and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that,
yeah. Yeah. Let's leave that shit. Yeah. Let's leave him out of it, man. Maybe we'll find him later or chat with him, man. But so, you know, I was bringing out that story that how it's kind of this, cause I've heard Damiano told me and what I read about too, is that it really kind of calls to you, that it sets up these things almost to where almost you don't have to find it, and almost searching for it got you fucked up. You know, as you hunted for it, it kind of said, fuck that. And it kicked your ass out and then brought you almost to where almost like you were supposed to be here instead.
Yeah, man. I think there's definitely, when people hear about ayahuasca and they learn about it, it can tap into a very deep curiosity that stems from like our ancient ancestral heritage. You know, those days back when we were on the plains dancing around fires and, you know, working with, spiritual realms and like psychedelic plants or shamanism of any kind, you know, where we don't have those kind of celebratory, deep, profound spiritual experiences that are ingrained into our, you know, into our routine. Instead, we've changed that out for like, you know, Nelly and like whatever, you know, dubstep and house music and top 40 in Irish pubs and you know, whatever,
and football games
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so And I think a lot of that stuff is superficial, along with the daily routine of, like you said, you know, well, it's Tuesday night, we're going to watch this series tonight and sit and eat, you know, popcorn or tortilla chips and watch TV. And I think that there is a need for us to have, for healthy humans to have those kind of spiritually profound experiences and to have something deeper and to really connect with their visceral kind of nature and the visceral roots. And I think when people learn about that, there's a percentage of people when they hear about ayahuasca, some people are just flat out scared. You know, they just, oh, I'd never do that. They're so afraid of discomfort, of being in discomfort or of testing themselves. A lot of people are afraid of what might come up. I was afraid of what might come up. Mm. I was like, dude, I got so many demons swirling around inside of me right now, you know, stuff that's probably buried. I'm just afraid. You get to hear these stories that you have to confront all your demons. And, you know, so a lot of people are afraid of that. Some people like that. You know, some people are looking for that. They want that challenge. I certainly did.
I was going to say for you, what it was facing the demons? Was it for you all of the mix? I mean, do you think you had to get to that bottom level first to go seeking it, or, you know what I mean? What was that first, you know, that walk to it for you for?
I had a realization, when I was in Australia. On top of all the other shit, I was crushing OxyContin, like based on my injury, right? I was taking, as soon as I got in the hospital, I was on morphine drip, and then that moved into OxyContin. I really love those little pills, man. Let me tell you, I was taking OxyContin.
You and one third of fucking America, man. I mean, shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And you love how they don't give you any counseling, right? They just say, by the way, here's the most addictive substance known to man. It's going to make you feel wonderfully awesome. It's going to be hard as fuck for you to kick this shit, and it may ruin your life, but here you go.
Yeah.
They don't even tell you that.
Yeah. And then I was going through my prescriptions a little bit faster than I should have been. Mm-hmm. So then they basically said, okay, well, this is your last prescription. Good luck. And, you know, then I was kind of forced to deal with that withdrawal, which is, man, that was something like I never experienced before. Back spasms and like nausea, diarrhea and fatigue and like anxiety, discomfort, and just freaking the fuck out pretty much.
A reminder of how fucked up and attached to it you were.
Yeah. So during that whole like time, that recovery period, down in Australia, I started journaling. One of my aunts actually sent me a journal while I was in the hospital, which was really cool. My Aunt Kathleen.
Shout out Aunt Kathleen.
Shout out Aunt Kathleen. So I started journaling in that. And one day I remember writing down in my journal that, like, you know, to me, it just, I couldn't escape these, like, it felt like they were little balls of garbage thought patterns that were just like swirling around my head and just fucking polluting and contaminating my life every single day. And, you know, I knew that needed to be fixed. If I was going to do anything, you know, if I was going to stay alive, that needed to be fixed. So, you know, that's kind of like, that was the real confirmation for me. Like, I just knew, as much as I had fear of confronting things, confronting my deepest, darkest demons, as much as I had fear of being in discomfort, you know, I knew it needed to be done.
So, did you have any fear of maybe possibly you reacting differently to it and going, what if I died or anything like that? I'm bringing it up because I'm trying to point out people that may not be at rock bottom, but still feel that way. You know, they may have these questions and fears to ever try it or do it, you know, that even a guy like you who's been down through the ringer, even when he approached it, felt these things, you know?
Did I have a question of like, what if I die?
Yeah, like, yeah. Did you question like a chemical response, a biological response, heart attack stuff? Did you worry anything along those lines?
Not at all, man. No. I mean, back then, the story was that nobody had ever died from ayahuasca because there were much, much fewer people that had tried ayahuasca. Now there's been a few incidents, very, very small percentage based on the, you know, the number of participants. Yep. But,
I only point that out because questions
circumstances.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I don't want anybody to listen to this to misconstrue as if like I'm pointing out the possibility. I only wanted to point out questions that people, you know, that are normally maybe having about, you know, that really could use a treatment like this that may stay away from it from irrational fears, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, for me, I guess as a kind of a special case, I wasn't concerned about that because I had a lot of confidence in my body's ability to withstand mind altering substances. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe other people it's a valid concern for sure, and that's why it's important to follow the proper procedures beforehand and do the personal checks and balances. For example, anyone who comes to Pulse Tours first has to answer a questionnaire and with all health related questions. Second, has a conversation with a medical intake coordinator who asks some questions that are obvious, some questions that are a little bit less obvious that, you know, are designed to really get a clear picture of a person's psychology and medical history to essentially avoid any red flags, avoid any risk.
Sure.
So, you know, people have to be aware of cardiac, pre-existing cardiac issues, pre-existing respiratory issues or some allergies, as well as medications that people are on. So, you know, like, yeah, it's valid to be concerned, and it's also very important to, you know, to look at medical history and medical condition, pre-existing medical conditions and substances that may be being taken, medications and substances.
Well, that's why it's important, I think, and I love the tours that you do like this because it as a way to start making it safe, to make those people feel good, to do it properly. It's why all this stuff I think should be legal. It's why I love things that MAPS does, you know, it's finding ways. So it doesn't have to be such a, ooh, the boogeyman of ayahuasca. It doesn't have to be that. It can be something else that's used properly. And I totally scrolled this off your story, man. So forgive me. I'll try not to do that, but I'm kind of want to go back again to where you were, man, to, you know, you were, had just had this experience, you know, you were having a revelation, dealing with addiction, withdrawing off of the opiates as you were coming off of that. That's where we were coming out of before I left field at us there.
Well, I mean, yeah, so coming off of opiates, it's a good thing. I'll put it this way. It's a good thing they sold codeine over the counter in Australia because that was the only way it could function until I left Australia. And I, you know, I grabbed a couple to bring with me. So it was just like those, paracetamol with codeine in it.
Yep.
And, those are in my little bag of treats when I started going through the OxyContin withdrawals. And I mean, when I was going through the most pain, I was just like, fuck this. And just started taking pills out of the bag that they gave me. Like, and those actually did help with the withdrawal symptoms a little bit. There must be some type of, like, codeine must be an opioid.
Yep. That's why they're not over the counter here anymore.
Right. 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 Yeah. I mean,
yeah, you had mentioned having an insight when you were coming off of those. It'll probably be difficult to remember, but you mentioned about an insight as you were leaving Australia after you were having this accident. But I think you had already experienced this in New Mexico is where you had gone to or were heading to.
So back to New Mexico then?
Yeah, I may have spewed us off left field, man. It doesn't. We were going in everywhere. That's my fault for trying to actually keep my tangential cognitive abstract podcast online and not just doing what the fuck I do, which is just go where I'm going. So, you know, as we were walking through the concerns, as people are approaching ayahuasca, you know, offering your tours, et cetera, we talked about your first experience with it, how it was almost serendipitous, you know, how you met someone and then it connected the right way. How often when people approach to your tours, do you see similar? I mean, are you, you know, what's the average person that's coming to your tours? Is it all addiction? Is it just maybe the average working person looking for something more? Where's that? Who are the people coming to you?
That's a very good question, actually. We have a really interesting demographic of people. And, you know, I'm not sure if the whole kind of field of ayahuasca is similar to ours. I suspect that it's because we have a little bit more of a younger team and kind of a younger image and more kind of energetic, adventurous, more health and wellness focused image as well. But yeah, we get a lot of people that are between the ages of 25 and 35, you know, that are, everyone has their issues that they're working on. You know, some of them, most of them are well-adjusted adults that have some type of trauma that they're trying to release or blockage in their lives. Some people are very well-adjusted adults that have a curiosity in spirituality or consciousness or expanding the mind, pushing the psyche, connecting with nature. We get outliers. We get some people who are pretty young. We get some people who are a little bit older, you know, the oldest, you know, that we've had are kind of 60s and 70. but most of the people are around average age, 27, 30 years old, with give or take, you know, 5 years on either side, health and wellness focused, adventurous. Most people listen to like Joe Rogan and stuff like that. So
I think it's important because I think when, you know, a lot of people that could actually use something like this, you know, stay at home moms, you know, single moms, or stay at home dads, whatever, you know, I think when they hear psychedelic ayahuasca, et cetera, I think the immediate image of hippie druggy goes into their mind. And for a person like you that's been running these tours for so long, to say, no, these are well-oriented, health, fitness, adventurous, mind explorers, put together people that are dealing with their deep shit like we all kind of are. I think that's important for people to realize that's who you're really helping. I think many people in their mind have this idea that you're only helping druggy ex whatevers, right, that are at the end of their rope and the last stop is the ayahuasca train.
That certainly does happen. You know, we definitely do get some extreme cases, you know, where people are in really bad shape and this might be, it might just be their last stop before suicide.
Yeah.
You know, it might be they're out of options. They have nothing else to turn to. They've tried therapy, you know.
Is that how it felt for you, right? That was kind of, you were kind of there, right? That's kind of what I was picking up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had gotten off of the opiate, so I wasn't addicted at the time. You know, I was when I first was kind of coming off my injury and made the decision to do ayahuasca. But by the time I did it, I wasn't per se addicted to anything. Was probably consuming a little bit too much alcohol.
But my hat's off to you, man, kicking a hard opiate addiction like that solo and titrating yourself like that. Fucking kudos, man.
Well, it wasn't really by choice. You know, if they would have kept giving me OxyContin in Australia, I would have kept taking it, man. I definitely would have kept taking it. And then when I got back to Canada, you know, I was already off the shit. So I wasn't about to go and like, maybe I even did ask for some in Canada, but you know, they were like, no, you're already healed, so you don't fucking need any more of this.
Good. In fact, big ups to Canada doctors there, man, for stopping your ass.
It might have been a different story in the U.S., hey? Like, no, oh, yeah, easily. We'll give you some OxyContins for $1,000.
Go to next door to the stay-at-home mom. She's got 50,000 of them sitting right fucking there, man. Call the babysitter. They're everywhere. It's disgusting. But for you, it wasn't, I mean, it seemed like maybe you had tried everything, doing so much psychedelics, acid, pushing that. You know, it seemed like it was almost rock bottom for you approaching it that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, back to psychedelics. So I had back in high school, I'd gotten into LSD, and I don't know how much in the way of spiritual experience I took from LSD. It was certainly amazing, and it blew my mind. But you know, it was kind of like me and my group of friends would drop acid and walk around the town, or like, you know, go camping. I grew up in the country, we camped a lot. Mushrooms, on the other hand, at a fairly young age, like in my late teens, doing the whole like camping and taking mushrooms and walking around the bush at night and all that kind of stuff, it did actually resonate with me as kind of a very special, very personal, very profound experience. So going forward, I had been taking mushrooms by myself, hanging out, you know, kind of going deep into, I always had these really important realizations when I took mushrooms. Not very lasting though, I found. It's not like, you know, you can have a really awesome mushroom experience, but it doesn't really change your brain chemistry a lot going forward. It can. I mean, there's a lot of research that's saying that it does and helps people with depression and stuff like that. But yeah, so when I got to that first ayahuasca experience, like just maybe a few minutes before going into it, I went out and stood by myself for a minute at the end of this roadway. We were like in the middle of the range in New Mexico. There was nothing around. It was just like range as far as you can see, this one little house on the prairie kind of thing. And I grabbed a handful of sand from the ground and like rubbed it in between my fingers, like a Russell Crowe does in Gladiator, you know, before battle. And I just looked up at the sky, and I just said, "Show me what you got. Like, I'm ready. Like, let's see what you got for me." And so I thought I was a little overconfident that my experience with LSD and with mushrooms was good enough to prepare me for what ayahuasca is capable of. Nope, not at all. It took away all of my self-control. I had zero self-control in my first ceremony. I was completely at the mercy of the medicine. I vomited uncontrollably all over myself and all over the floor of the ceremonial space. Like, big no-no in ceremony. Do not vomit inside because there's other people there. I just couldn't help it. I didn't know what was, I couldn't find my purge bucket. And it was dark, and I and all of a sudden I had no motor skills, and it was it just was coming. It had complete control over me, and I was rendered almost like helpless for a short period of time.
Yeah, we just lost half the people that would because they were like, "Oh, I think I can do this." Puke? What? Someone next to me may puke. I'll puke. No, I'm good. They'll bounce right there, and then they heard loss of full control. Nope, not in today's world. No, I'm not a control freak at all, but I don't need to do that. I mean, that's that fear, right?
Absolutely. No, that's what a lot of people, and yo, I'm not gonna lie, it happens. It happens. Every ceremony, you know, every retreat, maybe not every ceremony, but every retreat, there's at least one person who's like fully on top of things when they're sober. And then when they get on ayahuasca, they're rolling around on the floor or like screaming or
Isn't it
like.
amazing though? How cool is that? That the organized together person, you probably see them coming. They're all organized on the tour, and you're like, yep, you'll be rolling around on the floor in a minute.
Like no clothes on, like whatever.
So is that something though, like that people you see or can identify that seem more, you know, what in control or the control freaks, if you
No.
will, is that who you see mostly losing it?
No. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
Oh, wow. Just open, just whoever. So what I hear is you're telling me there's a chance somebody could go and not puke and have to be that actually there's a chance.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Lots of people go through, you know, a four ceremony retreat without purging once.
I like those stories. People should hear those stories. They should
hear
those.
You know, and sometimes it's all flowers and picnics, you know. I think it certainly attracts more attention to talk about the more intense experiences and the scary stuff. Maybe not the ideal kind of attention, but yeah, I mean there's experiences of all types and stripes, and certainly some are very much manageable. Like, I mean, I haven't felt out of control for like years. It was just that first one that I had that was really, really strong for me. And it's probably because I took a double dose.
I love how you drop that kind of like subtly at the end.
Yeah. Dosage is a hugely important variable in how things go. I mean, like, I know now if, like, when I go into ceremony, I know how much I need to take to have a nice, manageable, cool, chill experience, you know, that's going to give me some interesting, maybe open up some new thought patterns or give me some ideas. I also know how much I need to take to have a 4-hour feverish struggle and probably vomit excessively. And have some really strong psychedelic visions, and a super profound experience. It's not easy, but that's what comes with time. And so I might have 20 or 30 ayahuasca ceremonies a year, but or less. I did a few over New Year's this year, but kind of medium dose. Like, I don't often have super crazy ones anymore, like that often, because I get what I need from a medium dose. I don't need to go full retard, so to speak. You know?
never go full retard.
But yeah, I mean, people who come down and invest their money and their time in traveling down to the jungle oftentimes want to, like, once, you know, it's kind of scary and they don't know if they're going to do it or they're going to take a small dose. But then once you actually get in the ceremony and you get up to the mat and it's like, how much do you want? And, you know, people often will be like, fuck it, give me the full dose, you know? Mm. And then it might be a little bit difficult or strange, kind of like weird, like otherworldly kind of experience for a little while. But like, 9 times out of 10, as soon as the ceremony's over, everyone's on the same page. Whoa, that was fucking amazing. Like, they're out looking at the stars going, shit, man, I've never had such a profound experience. Or like, that was beautiful. I know exactly what I need to do now. Mm. You know?
Why shouldn't someone Google the recipe and make this in their house and do it?
I know people who do. I mean, it's not entirely bad, but you know, there's it's a lot better done in a setting like in the Amazon, in the native home of the medicine, where you're surrounded by the energy of the jungle,
I guess I asked the question, what's the difference between real Cuban food and microwave box Cuban food? That's kind of what I was asking, huh?
Yeah. I mean, like, for with lack of the option to go to Peru, you know, there are ceremonies happening all over the world, and those can be good. You know, then you're working with the medicine. You're not working with the medicine in the jungle, right? As you say, you know, there are some concerns about not, you know, working with experienced practitioners while taking the medicine. Of course, you wouldn't want to do it by yourself, you know, because there could be an incident. You know, you wouldn't want to end up choking on your own vomit or in a situation where you're doing something or trying to do something and end up causing an accident for yourself or whatever. So at minimum, you want to have like a sitter, someone there who's not on ayahuasca to kind of watch you. Probably the second best option is finding local ceremonies where there is like an experienced practitioner or shaman who's come up from South America or who has been working with the medicine for many years. I'd be careful of people who call themselves shamans.
I've seen a lot of this beware of fake shamans, and they set you up and take you to other countries, rob you. I've seen some crazy stories about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few of those incidents happening, and of course, anything bad that happens kind of reverberates through the community, and it seems like it's 100 times worse than it actually is.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I'm more talking about, like, people with little experience making it seem like they have lots of experience and then trying to run ceremonies or calling themselves a shaman. Like, that kind of stuff, it's, you know, almost better to do it by yourself in that case. Mm. So, I mean, it's always very important to know who you're getting in the ceremony with. And the quality of the medicine is also something that I question being in other countries, because, you know, it's like any other thing from South America. As soon as you ship it up six countries over, it's not the same thing that left the country, mm. you know, or it's somehow not as potent or strong. So it's always better to get the medicine in its native home, brewed up by the person who's giving it to you with plants that have just come straight from the jungle, kind of thing, you know?
Well, we like our food that way, right? We like our food local and homegrown. So I might as well take my psychedelics local and homegrown too. Because it's what, a two plant part mixture?
Yeah, there are different ways to mix it. Okay. So there's the core component of traditional ayahuasca always will be the ayahuasca vine. And then there are, I mean, the other primary active ingredient is a DMT-containing leaf, whether it be chacruna or wambisa. And then you can make it with, I'm not sure if it's Mimosa hostilis that contains DMT or Syrian rue. It might be Syrian rue. Maybe it's, I don't know, it is Mimosa, yeah. So you could mix it with that, but then you're talking about different types of admixtures. And then you can make ayahuasca out of Mimosa hostilis and Syrian rue. So the Syrian rue acts as the MAOI, similar to the ayahuasca vine. And then some, so those are like the kind of two core components. There's the MAOI and the DMT, but then you've also got some, shamans or organizations who mix in other plants such as toé, such as chirisanango, such as tobacco, and some that mix like a multitude of different plants and stuff like that to intensify the psychedelic experience or circumvent the chance that it won't be psychedelic. Sometimes it's, I mean, with the two traditional plants, chacruna and ayahuasca, you don't always get crazy psychedelic visions. Like it's almost like rolling the dice a little bit. You know, so like 8 out of 10 times, 7 out of 10 times, you're going to get really good visions, but not necessarily all the time. It might be just like more of an introspective kind of journey rather than being journey into psychedelic geometry and colors and plants and animals from like spiritual realm or whatever, you know?
Wow. So even more so why to have an experienced shaman doing this. I mean, I know I call them marijuana chefs that grow some serious shit that are like scientists. They take their stuff serious. They make it organic. They have all these tricks of trades to add this for less, more pain reduction, less, you know, all kinds of different ways that they grow their buds and maintain their thing. So for me, I'm, you know, I know how to grow weed, sure, but not like my chefs that I know how to do, you know? So for me, I see that kind of that separation to where if I'm doing this, I want to go to this experienced shaman who literally could say that. Do you want to go more this way? You want more this? That could literally make that individual compound for me and do that from experience, not from Google searching.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's how our programs work. It's very consultative. So as soon as people get there, they get a one-on-one consultation with the shamans and a translator, you know? So it's like, you're there. Here's what you're here to do. Here's what we're going to do to help you along the way. This is your journey. You know, every ceremony, after every ceremony, you'll be, you know, consulted in kind of a group therapy session. And then also if you need individual consultations We do that after every ceremony as well. So in every ceremony, the shamans work on your specific intentions and the work that you're trying to get done. So that is, you know, that's the medicine program. But then also an additional element, you know, is it's like you're coming all the way to Peru. Are you just doing that for ayahuasca? Or are you going there to like get to know, like have an intercultural immersion experience, get to know the indigenous communities, go exploring, go swimming in the Amazon, go like, you know, walking through the jungle, go see some exotic creatures and do all this. So, you know, we've kind of embraced that element of the journey as well, you know, cause you're going on this crazy psychedelic journey, but then also an adventure into the wild, into this unknown, uncharted territory, and get to take that experience, which is also helping to connect you to nature, which is part of the ayahuasca experience itself. And that's what I, you know, I feel like ceremonies being held in cities or whatever, it's not going to bring you down to nature like you would get surrounded by thousands of kilometers of pristine jungle. You know what I'm saying? And then also another kind of unique aspect that we've embraced and integrated into our center particularly is health and fitness. So I built a gym because I need a gym. If I'm going to be sitting in the jungle, I need to work out and all that stuff. So I built a gym at our ayahuasca retreat in the middle of the Amazon. I imported a bunch of like battle ropes and kettlebells and steel maces from Onnit. I put in a squat rack and a punching bag. We got a bunch of martial arts stuff there. And yeah, like bench press and free weights and spinning bikes and like elliptical trainers and all that shit. So you're literally like 4 hours away from the nearest city in the middle of the jungle. And it's like, you know, a sauna and you're working out. Like, so you've kind of got this like fat camp / spiritual retreat / adventure retreat, yeah, all wrapped up in one, you know?
Well, it sounds like the only thing you guys need on board is a mental health counselor who's trained in it, but doesn't believe in all the conservative shit and calls it mental training instead.
Well, man, you know, we're always open to run co-branded retreats. So if you want to set something up, like an Adam Lowry special,
we'll do a cognitive ramp and ayahuasca cognitive rampage, man.
That'd be cool.
We'll get the whole tribe to come down there, man. We'll bring our own tribe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'd totally work something out.
Man, so what's the day like, right? The day of. I love the gym idea, man. Like you're hitting the mind, you're hitting the body. Like I love that. That's beautiful, man. So if it's when you say retreat, that's the whole extension thing. I'm down there for a little while. I also love how you embrace the journey per se of it all, because it's true. Some people are coming just for that. Some are coming to immerse. I love that you incorporate that idea, because I always think that anytime I've done mushrooms, et cetera, it's like they know. You know, we talked about when we were kids, you know, if I ate it when I was a kid, sure, it gave me the party if that's what I wanted. It gave me the rave. And, you know, so if you're kind of going down there for whatever that internal journey is, I love how you kind of bring that out, cultivate it, bring it present, get it out there. And then that way, maybe when the trip comes, that's what it's for. So when it's the day of, right, what am I doing? What's the person going to do? You know, do we get up in the morning? Take me from the actual day of the ceremony. What's that like?
Well, so you spend one day traveling to get out there. We do the orientation and get you all set up. On the day of ayahuasca, you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. You go down to the Maloca. You drink a bowl of masato, which is fermented yuca juice. And we've got a combo shaman who will burn you a couple holes in your skin with a little piece of wood and drop a couple drops of frog poison on the holes, frog venom. And you're going to have about a 10 to 15 minute experience with Cambo or Sapo, which
we talked about that yesterday on the podcast. My friend Orlando, no, it wasn't on the podcast. We were sitting out after the podcast. That's right. And he was telling me he had tried that where they, he said that was one of the most intense feelings of his life.
Yeah, for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So some other centers or the ones I have worked with have used some type of plant mixture at the beginning of the retreat to induce vomiting. But sometimes those are a little too long lasting.
Sure.
So what we've been doing since the beginning, instead of doing like a plant mixture to induce vomiting and cleansing at the beginning of retreat, we use this frog venom, which is really super powerful, but not super long lasting. And so
kinda
I mean,
kind of like a DMT trip, like a, is it not 15 minutes though? Like we're what, 15, 20 on a decent DMT trip?
Yeah. You know, I've only done DMT once, and it's, in, smokable form.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it felt super short, But, yeah, the frog venom is not so like psychedelic. Some people lose consciousness for a minute, or like get a little bit dizzy.
Yeah.
But it's mostly physical. Like it's, it causes a reaction in the body because it's a venom, right? So yeah. It produces your body, it causes your body to like kick the immune system into overdrive and start, you know, it's almost like a mini fever, which increases blood pressure and releases bile from the gallbladder. So when people purge, they're really purging up a lot of the deep stuff from like deep in,
yeah,
deep in the guts. And it's oftentimes a different color than like kind of a bright yellow color. So it's a different experience. There's a lot of research on this frog venom.
Yeah.
It contains a couple dozen bioactive peptides, which have been shown to have, you know, all kinds of beneficial effects on conditions like ranging from diabetes to like, you know, HIV or AIDS and immunological disorders, things like that.
I even heard some things on MS with it, man.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not 100% up to speed on what all has been going on. There's some hospitals down in Brazil that are doing research on it, stuff like that. So anyway, so yeah, that's the first thing. You get up on ayahuasca day and you know, you don't eat anything. You go straight down to Maloca and you do this cambo. So that lasts an hour or two to get everybody in the circle. You know, we have a couple people doing it. And so, you know, they want to sit there and make sure that people are well cared for while they're undergoing the experience. So essentially the experience comes on, takes effect. It's really uncomfortable for a minute. And then usually there's, let's say 80% of the time there's a purge. So then you purge, and then our people are there to wash the venom off of your arm, and they terminate the experience by running water over your head and kind of like, you know, really brushing off the medicine. It comes down very quickly. So it's, you know, comes on very quickly, comes off very quickly. And then you have breakfast. There's some, that's when we have the individual consultations. So during that day, you'll be able to speak with the shamans individually along with the translator. And we often have a jungle excursion in the afternoon. So one of the milder jungle excursions that don't take too much. We have one jungle excursion every day or two on the days off, like a daytime one and a nighttime one, which is usually catching crocodiles under the stars.
Nice.
Yeah, it's fun. So then usually a light one on the first day, and then in the afternoon at about 4 o'clock, we get together for a floral bath. So our female shaman prepares a mixture of different plants with water, which participants in the program come out, you know, like at about 4 or 5 p.m. and essentially put an intention into the bucket of water and like kind of wash themselves with this bucket of floral water that the shaman has prepared. It's a tradition, and it's meant to protect from negative spiritual entities in the ceremony and bring in love and stuff like that. So we do that, and then it's pretty much chill out time until the ceremony. We have been experimenting a little bit with some sound healing, sound bathing, I guess. My new business partner brought a bunch of instruments down, like really interesting instruments that were recommended by a well-known guy named Porangi. It's a Brazilian guy who's doing this, a lot of sound healing. You'll see him in Aubrey Marcus's new documentary, Ayahuasca. He did the soundtrack for that. So he does some crazy stuff, man. We're also talking to him to do some co-branded retreats down there this year.
Nice.
So we do a little bit of the sound healing stuff, and then 6:30 is quiet time. We kind of do a little meditation or breathing exercise, talk about how people can use mapacho in the ceremony. Mapacho is like the tobacco, jungle tobacco, which is another important medicinal plant used in ceremonies. So you usually give people a little bit of a lesson on how to apply mapacho in the ceremonies for positive effect. And then 7:30 is go time. Everybody, the shamans come in, sit down. The maloka is dark, lit by candles. So we have a few candles up in front of the shamans in the middle so people can see where they're going. People come up one by one. Everyone gets to choose their own dose. So, we have several different size cups there, and you can just point out whatever cup size you like, and the shamans will fill it up for you. And you drink it. You go and sit down, and once everyone has finished drinking, the candle lights go out, and then that's when the fun begins.
Oh, man. Thanks for walking us through that. I know a lot of that is kind of the secret intel of how it goes down, and really, but I think it's important. I think people hearing what it's like can ease their mind. Like, I think a lot of information you brought like today will do that for people, is will make people kind of say, okay, maybe it's not so, you know, what they thought or what they've been told it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I had a parting word to say for people considering it, I would say have respect, not fear. It's nothing to be afraid of. The only thing to fear is fear itself. But it is to be respected. It's something that needs to be like prepared for and treated with, you know, you're going into working yourself. If you can't come into it with a sense of respect and a sense of like preparedness, you know, then I wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, if you do feel like a curiosity or a calling, I think ayahuasca can be a very important part of the human experience. It certainly has for me, and I continue to use ayahuasca when I need it. You know, I use it as a tool when I need to either clean my body or, you know, get over something that's been bugging me or kind of set some new direction in my life or whatever. It can be a very, very useful tool. And we get a lot of people who come back every year. As long as you kind of approach it the proper way, I think it can be very useful.
Yeah, you definitely didn't have to park, because I did have one more question, brother. So if you don't have to go anywhere.
I'm good to go, man. I'm good to go. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that was the wrong terminology, but.
No, I'll take a mini cognitive rampage before you drop. I dig it. I dig it. I wanted to know, and here I go abstract all the way back. How did the one trip in New Mexico, how did you get from there to owning your own tour and doing this for people?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. That trip changed my life. That New Mexico journey changed my life. And I mean, it just blew me away. I saw immediately like how important the medicine was. And during that trip, I was more focused on like on my family. I was seeing like my family in the ceremonies and like, you got to do this. Like, you got to experience this. So after that trip, I was just I mean, I just believed in it so much that I started talking about it and sharing knowledge about it within my networks. There wasn't a lot of mainstream discussion about it. It wasn't on CBC News, or you know, it wasn't on like
Joe hadn't brought it up yet.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I think he started talking about it like 2011 or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just started sharing it with my friends and family. Like, you guys got to do this. Now, a lot of them just thought I was fucking crazy because.
Oh, here goes Dan again. Jesus. what's he on now? You know, here he goes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my aunts and uncles, I got some aunts and uncles at healthcare, and you know, I mean, whatever, you're just going down to the jungle to get high and all that, you know, like,
oh, such judgment. Now, come on, Aunt Kathy, you sent the diary, damn it.
Well, it was a different one. So, I mean, I started talking about it, and for my own personal reasons, I was like really called to continue exploring the medicine. So, about six months later, I had arranged for me to, I had arranged a job, like a volunteer position at a retreat center down in Puerto Maldonado, the original one that I tried to go to the first time I was there. I was in contact with the owner, and so they were looking for like chefs, writers, artists, and I was just like, yeah, I can write. So I sent him a couple of samples of my writing, and one of which was my analysis of my very first ayahuasca experience, which I emailed to my entire contact list like the day after my ceremony.
Yeah.
So I got a job as a resident writer, and so I went down to Peru about 6 months after my first ceremony, and spent a month at this place, and did a bunch more ceremonies, like had some more super crazy experiences, and like, you know, blogged about it, talked about it, like it was just getting out there. And then eventually some of my friends asked me if I could help guide them on a trip down to Peru. So another thing to mention was that a few years before this, I started working for a tour company in South America. So I like my friends already knew that I was the traveling guy. I was the guy that was going on adventures down to South America and stuff like that. Right. So then those two paths intersected when I was already known as the travel guy, the crazy jungle dude, you know, then people started hearing about, now I'm the crazy psychedelics guy. Eventually, you know, people started being like, yo, that sounds dope. I want to go. So then I started leading people down there, you know, just kind of started with friends and family, organizing trips.
I love it. No business plan, no investor. I love it. I love it. Like, all right, I'm just going to do this shit now.
Yeah, pretty much. I just took all my past experience and you know, kind of just started winging it guerrilla style. You know, just bought my own web domain, designed a logo, you know, built my own website with help of a friend, you know, just work like very basic WordPress stuff. And just got lucky, got a few lucky breaks in the public sphere. And then it eventually got to a point where it was possible to take it full time. So, but for the first couple of years, I was still working other jobs. And then doing this as a hobby, like building up the online side as a hobby, and then leading a few trips a year, just, you know, very like, wasn't making any money. I was pouring money into it. And then eventually there was that break where it's like back in 2013, I was like, I've had it with these fucking jobs. I can't stand working for anybody else. I hate this guy who's like bossing me around and threatening me with firing me. And I'm like, I'm over it, man. So, I made a decision like, okay, it's time to just bite the bullet and make this thing work. And so that's what I did.
I love it. I think you said something important, man, that a lot of people don't really look at is they look at times in their life where they've either held this job or that job that wasn't really who they are, et cetera, and wasn't their passion or whatever. And they dismiss it. They dismiss that experience from it. And this is now two shows in a row I've quoted my mama. My mama must be quite smart. So shout out to you again, mama. Is that every job that you ever have pays into something else. And there's so many times, and I love that you did that, that you look back and said, okay, this is what I'd done, everything together, gathered that, rather than either just, you know, throwing it away, that doesn't mean anything, that's not really a career, that's not even a field, but you looked at everything you'd done and pulled that together to create something. And not like this passion, right, of people talk about, I discovered this passion for you. You just experienced life and said, this is it, and pulled this together, and it just went that way, man. I think that is beautiful. I think people need to look at their experiences all the way up to their life and making whatever their next choice is to do, man. You're inspiring for that and many other levels too, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's a good observation. I think it's important to be resourceful, you know, and to, you know, go into your past and look at all of those tools and resources and experiences you have at your fingertips that you can leverage and build off of and use to create something unique. In my case, you know, there was like when I was in sales back in the day, even though I didn't really like it, I knew that I always kind of was, even though I wasn't where I wanted to end up, I was always kind of like conscious of like, okay, well, I know I can leverage this for future things, even though I don't know what those future things are yet. I know that, you know, I know that I can leverage sales. And then when I was leading tours, I wasn't making any money, but I knew that I was learning Spanish. I knew that I was learning, I was like, you know, being responsible for people, learn how to be resourceful and travel. And like, I knew that was going to work out well for me. Hmm. You know, and like all this intercultural stuff, personal management, being able to like, you know, carry my stuff around with me, be like a portable office and like, you know, live on the schedules and respond to diverse emergent issues and problems and challenges that come up. I knew that was going to serve me in the future. And so, you know, like ultimately I ended up going back and taking all those experiences and being able to weave them together into a unique form of self-employment, you know?
Yeah, you seem like, I write in my book a lot about becoming the master of the silver lining, and the way that you talk, you seem like a master of a silver lining, able to look back, you know, and I think people need to really look at that and say, you may be in a job right now where you don't like, or, you know, isn't the passion, but really pause, like you're saying there, and go, what am I learning by being here? Rather, other than just being tolerant as shit, what else am I gonna, you know, gather?
Work to learn, man, you know, work to learn and work to earn, but work to learn more importantly. You know, if you have a job, like take as much as you can from it. Learn from the guys in the company that you want to be like, you know, work closely with the entrepreneur or the, you know, or whoever that inspires you in the company. Because eventually you can take that knowledge and apply it to something that is, you know, more self-satisfying, I guess. That was always, I think, I don't know who I heard that term from. I think Tim Ferriss, but yeah, that was over the past couple of jobs I had. That was always just like, okay, I'm here. I know I don't want to keep working here. I know I want to be an entrepreneur, but here I have this opportunity to work closely with another entrepreneur who's doing a lot of things that I want to do. So I'm going to learn from him, and, you know, so it's kind of like a paid mentorship in a lot of ways. Hmm.
You know, you mentioned Tim Ferriss, who is somebody I listen to and read up on. So I'll steal from him in his essence and ask that final cognitive rampage question, man, which is, if you could go back to your 23-year-old self, what advice would you give your 23-year-old self?
Damn, that's a tough one, because looking back, it's like, it's hard to say that I would want anything to have gone any differently, you know? Regardless of any potential challenges I have right now, I kind of feel like I'm in the ideal place in my journey. I'm really happy with how things turned out. And, you know, before that first ayahuasca ceremony, I might have had regrets and, you know, tried to condemn myself for like making mistakes. But it was actually during that ceremony where I had this like revelation. It's like, whoa, I'm in the perfect place in time and space right now. And if I would have done anything differently along the way, I wouldn't be here, which means that everything happened just as it did so that I would get here, you know?
I think you answered it right there. I love it. I love that you answered. I'm kind of shooting down how the question really is kind of
obsolete. What comes to mind is like when you ever seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
Of course.
it, like when they come back from the future Bill and Ted come back to see like present Bill and Ted, and they're just like, dudes, you guys are gonna have one hell of a time. And it's like, say what's up to the princesses for me, you know. that would probably be the extent of my advice to my 23-year-old self.
Oh, that's the fucking best answer, man. That is fucking the best answer. Oh shit. I think that's the best one I got so far right there. Man, that's good, bro. The best advice I'd give, man, is say hello to the princesses for me. Oh man. I dig it, man. Oh shit. Well, you'll come back on, right? Chat again, man. Tell me what's you know, I'd like to maybe catch up next time about how difficult it is, laws changing, any ability maybe to be doing that over here soon, that kind of stuff. Would you come back on, maybe walk that route with me?
Hell yeah, man. So I'm going to the MAPS conference in April in Oakland. So there's like
shout out to Brad. Like, Brad MAPS and Rick Dublin out there. Brad's been on the show before. Stuff.
Oh, cool. There's going to be a whole bunch of speakers there, a lot of information about current events in the field, all that kind of stuff.
Shout them out. What's the dates and all that stuff. Give definitely MAPS some love on there.
Yeah, man, for sure. so it's called the Psychedelic Science, Conference 2017. So psychedelicscience.org is the web domain, a whole bunch of different ticket options. I think there's still plenty of space. There's like, I mean, I had a brief glance at the speakers list. There's like 50 different speakers that, you know, I haven't even heard of. Some of them I have, like, you know, Dennis McKenna is going to be there. Gabor Mate is going to be there. And a bunch of others that are, well, you just had him on your podcast last week or something, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not open up that Pandora's box with Adam right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Adam, Adam's going to try to remain professional right now. So, yeah, you said the name and I kind of went, yeah, he was definitely scheduled to be on the podcast for sure for 6 months on my calendar, exactly when. And yeah, sure. We'll leave it at that. Maybe it may happen again, but I'm not so sure, not so sure the help of Gabor Mate is going to is going to like that very much. But yeah, I'll just keep it professional. And okay. Yeah, he was definitely supposed to be on the show. And I would love to explore his trauma theory, et cetera. But now on the most part, I'm kind of having more fun tearing trauma theory apart.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, somebody's got to, right? Somebody's got to play devil's advocate to pointing out obvious, to blanket every statement as being caused by trauma.
Any theory needs to stand up to rigorous testing and criticism, right?
And I will be happy to oblige that over the next year. Yeah, I don't fixate at all. I'm I hold no grudges, no, at all. But yeah, so the speakers are going out there.
Lots of good speakers.
Yeah, tons of them going out there though, man. I was trying to make the last one something similar that MAPS put together out there. Brad was fucking excellent on the show, man. Brad was really cool. Brad Burge was great to talk to.
Brad Burge.
Yeah, he's the marketing director guy for them out there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so nice. Definitely shout out to him. Where can everybody else find you? Because I know some people are going to be hunting down some tours now, man. So where do they find you? How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, well, pulsetours.com, pulsetours.com. That's where you find and learn about and book ayahuasca retreats with us. I just launched a book called pulseofthejungle.com. I'm actually just sending out the signed copies today from my pre-sales campaign. And I am working with a team who is like a day away from launching a personal website at danielcleland.com as well. So that'll kind of includes a central hub for anything related to what I'm getting into, which is a little more technology and business and lifestyle kind of stuff. And then the ayahuasca stuff will kind of be focused in the Pulse Tours realm. Yeah, if anyone wants to read about my story or how Pulse Tours formed, you know, we talked a lot about that today, of course, but then that's all in the book, Pulse of the Jungle, which is available on Amazon right now. Actually, yeah. Are we live?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Until tomorrow, people can get the Kindle version for 99 cents. Damn. Today's actually the official book launch for my book.
Oh shit.
So yeah. So the publisher's got it on for 99 cents until tomorrow. So
nice. Well, we linked it up. It's all on the post. So the link to your book is also on the post that we posted to go live to this show. As soon as this show comes down, we'll end up posting it on iTunes. So it'll go everywhere as a podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, a whole bunch of other places. But we'll add the link to that post too, to Pulse of the Jungle, to buy your book for sure.
Awesome, man. Much appreciated.
I appreciate the interview on the launch, man. I'm in, dude. Yeah, definitely the launch of Pulse of the Jungle, man, by my boy Dan Cleveland here for sure.
I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to you. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope we can do it again, maybe sometime in the jungle, you know, come down and rock out a badass podcast in the jungle, man.
Sold. Let me check with, I don't know, myself, Roxy. Can we go to the jungle? All right. My pug doesn't want to go, but I'll go.
Yeah, she might get eaten down there.
Quick. Quick, man. And I won't be swimming in the Amazon. Look, I'm an avid fisher, diver, spearfisher. I've been doing it my whole life. But no, I'm good. I'll watch y'all swim in the Amazon all you want to.
You'll change your mind once you get down there.
Yeah, I mean, like run in, run out. You know what I mean? But, no, I'll watch. I swear to God, I'll watch.
That's cool. No pressure.
Oh, no, man. I'm just joking. I probably would. I'd be that guy. I'd be like, give me that light dose. And then I'd be in front of him and be like, double it, Pops. Let's go. Hey, man. Thank you, dude. I look forward to having you back on, man. Thanks for coming on again. And your book, good luck to it. Everybody else will buy that damn book.
Thanks, brother.
All right. I have lost the mouse to do anything. I can't even end the show properly, dude. Oh, man. All right, brother. Love you. Take care.